Hello, and welcome back to the Death and Grief Talk podcast. I'm your host, Joelle Maldonado, and I'm also known as the Grave Woman. I was first introduced to Caitlin Doty through the Ask a Mortician YouTube channel in 2012. Caitlin Doty is a mortician, advocate, and bête noire of the traditional funeral industry. In 2011, she founded the Funeral Reform Collective, the Order of the Good Death, which has spawned the death positive movement. Her educational web series, Ask a Mortician, has been viewed almost 200 million times, and all three of her books, Smoke Gets in Your Eyes, From Here to Eternity, and Will the Cat Eat My Eyeballs, were New York Times bestsellers. Caitlin was the first funeral director, and might I add, first female funeral director, that I ever saw articulately, honestly, and publicly discuss the good, bad, and ugly about the death care industry while challenging the way that we do death in this country. She was also the first person to encourage me to expand my then blogspot.com blog into a YouTube page. Over the years, I've watched not only her YouTube channel, but she and her career blossom. The thing that I respect most about Caitlin is that though she has amassed countless supporters through her books, social media, public speaking, and nonprofit, she somehow seems to remain grounded while balancing both the roles of the observer and the advocate.
Hello, Caitlin, and welcome to the Death and Grief Talk podcast.
Thank you for having me. I'm good. How are you?
I'm excited. I'm really excited to talk to you and have you on the podcast. This is kind of like a milestone for me. So I'm really feeling good right now.
Why?
As I was sharing with you before we started recording, I have been watching you for, oh my God, since about 2011, 10 maybe. And I feel like everything that you do is so centered on helping people connect with their relationship with death and grief, or educating people about the way that people have died and grieved over the centuries. I just really want to have a heart-to-heart conversation with you and get to know you a little bit, because I feel like there's so much under those bangs that we don't get to see, so to speak.
Behind the bangs is all secrets. The bangs. Yes. Well, I mean, congratulations to you. I've really been impressed with your work and your growing body of work and the growing specificity of your activism and your advocacy. And I'm so proud to be talking to you today.
Thank you. That really means a lot. Thank you. So Caitlin, let's go back to little girl Caitlin. First question, did she have bangs?
Little girl, actually, well, here's the real secret, is that when I was young, I had almost exactly the same haircut I do now, which for those of you who are listening to it as a podcast is blunt bangs, like Betty Page bangs, and, you know, kind of little curl bob. I had almost this exact same hair, except it was much lighter, borderline blonde.
What?
Which is extremely off-brand for me. Right. And I'm horrified that that is the truth, but I cannot lie to you. It is, in fact, the truth. And my hair has obviously gotten much, much darker as I've gotten older, as many, many people's hair does. But yeah, I had this hair, but it was, I would even say blonde. I would say blonde. So if you want the real, you want to open with the real vulnerable secret, that's it.
Awesome. Wow. So that was my next question. Did you dye it? But you said it just got darker over time.
It got darker. I mean, I dye, there's been times I've dyed it over the years. You can watch the videos over many years. And sometimes my hair is my natural color. And sometimes it's a much darker, like almost black. So when it's almost black, it's dyed. But when it's the kind of very dark brown, almost strawberry, that's my natural hair at this point. And now I have to dye it a little bit at the top because it's starting to go gray. And listen, I think the fiercest hair in the world is women who can have dark hair with gray streaks or gray overlaying it. I think if I could have that be my hair right now, or just pure gray, I would sign up immediately. But at this point, since they're so new, it's just like wild, you know, coarse grays growing straight out of the top of my head. So they're not quite complying with my demands yet, but I'm hoping for big things for my gray hair.
So back to little girl Caitlin with her blonde bangs. Were you, I don't want to say death obsessed, but were you morbidly curious? Because I can remember being extremely morbidly curious as a child. I remember going to my great grandmother's funeral in Pennsylvania and wondering, why is she in this bed box? Why are we watching her sleep? Who put on her makeup? Who did her hair? Why are we putting her in the ground? And just wrecking my brain, trying to figure out what was death, dying, grief, and why I was witnessing it. What was your understanding of all of this? Or did you have curiosity about it? What was that for you?
Well, I definitely had curiosity. And it's interesting to me how many people, actually, especially recently, that I've talked to that ended up in the death industry that really had a real connection with funerals or with the dead body or care for the dead body. And I don't know that I had that, but what did happen was my kind of origin story around death is when I was about 8 years old at my local mall. It was Halloween, and I went and I saw a young child fall from the second story balcony of this big open air mall and heard the child hit the ground to what I assume was the child's death, although I never got that completely confirmed. But it really, really just ratcheted up my fear and anxiety of death. And I was constantly worried that somebody was going to die, that my friends were going to die, that my parents were going to die, that my grandparents were going to die, that my dog was going to die. And I think that it gave me a sense of the world that was a little more precarious, and also really pushed my particular interest, which, unlike maybe a lot of funeral professionals, like I was talking about, that's more centered on the body and care and service in that way, was really the question of, like, why is it like this? Why is our culture like this? Why am I so afraid of death? Why did I have no connection with death before this? Why did the fear of death hit me like a train? Why did I have no thing to compare this to or education to have? And I think that is actually really what pushed me to study death in culture, which probably is actually truer to my greatest passion than individual service with the family, which I think is the more typical funeral director narrative and how they come to it.
Definitely. And hearing you tell that story brings up so much for me, because when I was about 7 or 8 years old, my best friend at the time passed away in a freak accident. She was playing hide and seek with her siblings. And I don't know if you remember, the old Land Rovers had the tire, the spare tire in the back. And she crawled in where the spare tire would have been to hide from her brothers and sisters playing hide and seek. It closed on her and she suffocated.
Oh my gosh. I didn't know. What a terrible story.
Yeah. And I don't so much remember my reaction to her death. I don't remember going to her funeral, but I remember, again, being fueled with a fire to know, where, if this person isn't here anymore, where are they? And I think for me, that fueled the spiritual context of what I do, about our spirit and how our essence remains here in a sense, but not in the physical form. And so you mentioned culture. What have you learned that has been most impactful about the way that people in different parts of the world view death, dying, and grief? Because you've traveled extensively, you've talked to, I'd imagine, hundreds of people around the world. What has been the most impactful for you?
I think the most impactful, I started out, before I even really began to travel and study this, I already basically had the thesis that there's no right way to grieve. There's no right way to handle the body. There's no right way to have a funeral, which seems simple enough, but sometimes the way that people, especially in the United States, talk, or even funeral directors in the United States talk, you would think that there is one respectful thing to do with the dead body. Right. And it is just happens to be the thing that the American funeral industry most commonly does, or what we might call a traditional or conventional funeral. So I already had that as my thesis, but being able to travel and see with my own eyes and talk to the families and see death rituals that are just so wildly outside what we would consider normal or respectful. I always go back to the example of being in South Sulawesi in Indonesia, where they have a thing called the Manene, which is a ritual where the bodies come out of their graves and the family cleans the bodies, redresses what are essentially mummies. They speak to them, they still have a relationship with them. And you think, okay, here I am, and they're disinterring mummies and cleaning them, you know, and speaking to them. What is this all? Totally normal. It feels totally normal. It's people just like you and me. They're on their cell phones. You know, they're sending a Facebook or Instagram about here's me and my uncle who happens to be a mummy. They're having a potluck. They're smoking cigarettes. It feels absolutely like any kind of get together most cultures would have or experience. And there just happens to be a bunch of disinterred mummies there. And being able to be in spaces like that over and over again, where somebody is doing something with the dead body or grieving in a way that feels extremely different than what you or I may have grown up with or know, and seeing how helpful it is for the family or community, it just really makes me believe that we should not be putting specific boundaries or forcing anybody into anything with their dead body or with their grief that doesn't work for them.
Definitely agree 100%. That practice sounds a lot like Fama Dayana or turning of the bones in Africa. It's so amazing to me, the more research I do, how many Western cultures have so many things in common, like you said, that are so opposite to what we do here. Could you imagine? I think of my grandfather, like going and basically digging up his grave in the national cemetery and taking him out. It just seems so far-fetched initially, but how beautiful that comfort that they have with their deceased. We talked and joked a little bit about hair before, but it's obvious that you are a blue-eyed white woman that is going into these cultures and having these experiences. And I'm curious to know, how are you received by the individuals in the culture? And how do you ensure that in telling their stories that you're not appropriating, but showing more appreciation than anything?
Yeah, that's a great question. First of all, I do not go anywhere that I'm not invited.
Ooh.
Or that has not been arranged in advance.
That's a message in itself.
Yeah. And sometimes, you know, I'll visit cemeteries and places that are open to the public without necessarily saying like, here I'm coming. But as far as any sort of ritual, any sort of ceremony, any sort of burial, any sort of interview, I'm always working with people who know who I am and know that I'm coming. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that's the most important thing to me. I don't have, I will say that as much as some of my work borders on journalism, I have a lot of trouble with it because I'm not a very pushy person. I have a really hard time having that kind of journalistic energy where I'm like, I'm just going to call them up and I'm going to show up and I'm going to make it happen. I absolutely cannot do that. I cringe thinking about doing that. So I'm like a vampire. I really do have to be invited in, not just because I'm deathly pale, but also because I need to be invited in before I will go anywhere. And also it's very important to me to, let a lot of interviews, make sure they're telling their story, and also making sure that a lot of the writing that I do is trying to dissect and understand and sometimes be very critical of the American funeral industry. But I feel really comfortable in criticizing that, and especially in the sort of like white American funeral industry that grew up at the beginning of the 20th century and the capitalism of that kind of funeral industry. And so I feel very comfortable criticizing that. And if I can bring in these other voices that speak to that and can offer a counter narrative to that, that's really important to me, but it is absolutely not my job to go into any other culture and say, I wouldn't do this. Mm-hmm. I'm going to criticize. I don't like how you do this disinterment ritual. I don't like how you spend money in this way. I would never do that. either. So I try and keep criticism directed at myself or the funeral industry that I am a part of. And I try and make sure I'm always invited to anything having to do with death or dying or grief.
Definitely. I'd imagine that you don't just go in for a day or so. I don't know what your process is, but I imagine that you're invited in and you get to spend time with these communities and that you almost form a level of attachment to them. And I'm curious as to what that level of separation looks like and how do you honor those individuals for allowing you to have that front seat to one of the most sacred times of their lives.
I think an interesting extension of that is actually going back to South Sulawesi and the time mm-hmm. that I was there, which was for a longer period. And we were able to stay and this is with Paul Kudinaris, who he has really done an amazing thing for me in getting me into a lot of these spaces and arranging it, because he has been going to these places, traveling to these places, photographing these places. Bolivia is another great example, for years. So they all know him, and he is, talk about like how they react to him. He is very distinctive looking. he is a, if you want to Google Paul Kudinaris, you will see what a interesting looking man he is. And when he shows up, actually the fact that he looks so intense really opens a lot of doors for him, because people are just so fascinated by him. They have so many questions about him. They're, you know, what's going on with you? That he, and he's just great at opening these conversations. So he has been a really good friend, and he has been a real someone who has organized these kind of access points for me, which I'm very grateful for. Mm-hmm. And he organized us to stay in one of the homes in this village through the Manene ritual and festival. And we had been there for days and days. Can you hear that? Okay. There's loud construction noises next door, but as long as it's not blasting through. So we had been there for days and days, sleeping in these tall, beautiful houses that are almost like boats on stilts that mm-hmm. are in this particular region of Indonesia. And after we had been there for days, we know that in this region as well, these bodies are embalmed in a way and kept in the homes, in these bedrooms for sometimes years. And we didn't know the whole time we were there that basically right next door, you know, 20 some feet away, the grandmother of the family had died and was embalmed and was in this room.
Wow.
And it wasn't until we had been there for, you know, maybe a week and had gotten to know this family and had eaten with this family and had hopefully shown them a great deal of respect and reciprocity that the last day before we left, they were like, "Do you want to come meet grandma?" And up we went, and it was absolutely incredible to see, you know, because we had seen all of the mummified bodies that were removed from the graves, but actually being able to see one that was still in the home and was still being dressed and lying in the home, and that people were bringing, you know, we brought her cigarettes and we brought her snacks, because that's what you bring someone after they've died. And that, you know, to me ended up being a real honor for me to be invited into that space. And that's never a space that I would assume ever that I would be invited into, or would show up and say, "Can I see her? What's going mm-hmm. on?" Even though, I mean, that's not necessarily wrong. I think journalists or, you know, anyone would tell you that it's, you know, it's okay to ask, but I would not have asked. So the fact that they invited us in and allowed us to experience that was for me really moving.
Wow, that sounds like a definitely beautiful experience. And you must have had some type of deep connection with them for them to invite you into that space. But I want to pivot a little bit from death to life. I'd imagine that spending time around these different cultures and learning their philosophies about our purpose here and, you know, just being alive has fueled something within you. So what have you seen in your travels that has impacted not only the work that you do and your mission and your goals and what your purpose is, but your belief about life?
Yeah, I say sometimes that I wear death-colored glasses because I think that I do see a lot of things through the lens of death. And being in, I often think about this time in Mexico for Day of the Dead, and we got to go to this pretty rural area and rural cemetery. And on the Day of the Dead, it was just lit up in this absolutely glowy, orange, warm candles and lights and flowers. And the support that that gives people who have lost people is just stunning. And the fact that people who were there decorating the graves of people who had died 10 years ago, 20 years ago, or their children who had maybe died in childbirth or when they were toddlers, and parents were still coming to visit because that grief obviously doesn't go away. And when I say that, yeah, it seems obvious that that grieving doesn't go away and those feelings don't go away. And yet in the United States, we absolutely treat it like it does and like it gets cut off and like there's no lasting relationship. And you asked me earlier what I think my main takeaway from all my travels has been. And I think the number one takeaway actually may be that the relationship with the dead does not end. Mm-hmm. Your relationship with the dead does not end. And of course, that may look very different for you through your spiritual model or your cultural model or whatever it is. But so many places around the world do, I would argue, a much better job of keeping up that relationship and having rituals and having tangible things to do to revisit that relationship with death and revisit the person who's died, whether it's literally bringing out their mummified body or visiting and decorating their graves or turning their bones or disinterring them and moving them to a different place or having a big get together, just really remembering that relationship and not cutting it off. And the fact that here in the United States, we get maybe 3 days of bereavement leave, that's just not enough. And that's just not doing it. And also, even if we only have this shortened time to grieve, then you need a really impactful funeral. You need if you have this shortened time to experience the death, your funeral has to be full of interaction and ritual and community. And most people don't get that either in the United States. So I think when I speak about our funeral industry and the reforms that need to happen, they're really based around those things not being available to most people.
Definitely. How much responsibility do you think falls on individual citizens versus the responsibility of the death care industry?
Ooh, that's a great question. Because it really was, if you look into the history of the early 20th century death system in the United States, you find, yes, a really big push to turn it into an industry. You find the men coming together and saying, we are funeral directors now, or we are morticians, and these are special licenses and special groups, and you have to go to these special schools. And a lot of them were put on by the embalming chemical companies to say, you know, here's how we're going to put these classes together, and then we're going to get you licensed, and then now you're the only one who can do it. And so that was a big shift. And I do blame the foundations of the industry for that, absolutely. But at the same time, the reason that it worked so effectively does fall on the public, because especially moving in out of the Civil War and then really into World War I, there was just so much death on such a horrific scale that a lot of citizens kind of went, I can't deal with this anymore. I can't be responsible for kind of mediating my own dead bodies and my own death. And there was appeal in the technology of embalming because that's how it would allow a body to stay fresh for a long period of time, especially before refrigeration. So you could extend this viewing period. And it also meant that you were middle class or you were upper class if you got to have this kind of new fangled fancier funeral. So it definitely was a dance between this new industry and the public. But I think so I, you know, as far as blame, I mean, I guess I don't blame anyone since all those people are dead at this point. But at this point, as far as how we can reform our funeral industry, is to allow people to, especially individuals, to realize that they don't necessarily have to exist within the funeral system the way that it's assumed that you might have to, that you have a lot more individual power and you have a lot more power to do things within your family and within your group.
I think COVID has kind of shed a light on that. We're seeing a lot more DIY funeral planning and people doing memorials after cremation now. Do you think that's a good thing for our industry?
Oh yeah. I mean, I don't, you know, this is why I'm somewhat controversial, is that I don't work for the funeral industry in a sense. Like, I'm not here to, you know, I'm not the representative of NFDA. Right. You know, that's certainly, I am really kind of the, hope to be one of the voices for alternatives for people. And the reason that I am is because I don't think, you know, the sort of funeral that rose up in the 20th century, the embalmed body, the maybe the viewing, the hearse to the cemetery, the grave with the vault and the headstone and all of those things, that doesn't really need a spokesperson. That's the default. That's what for many, many years, for, you know, 100 plus years, everybody just kind of got. And yes, you had the cremation revolution, and that was people's answer to people who did not want that kind of funeral, who thought it was too expensive or had values that didn't align with theirs. They turned to just direct cremations. And that was kind of the Jessica Mitford model. But I don't think that that's necessarily the only answer either, because that's just a complete rejection. So I am part of a group of people that's been around for a while, and that's been advocating for quite some time, of people who are like, hey, okay, so you want still a really involved funeral, but you might want it to have a greener sense about it. You might want it to be more involved. You're a family member who might want to be more involved. You might want to have the body at home. You may want to, you know, dig a simple grave and put a shrouded body straight in there, so there's not all the metal and concrete being used. You may want to actually decompose into the earth, because that's very meaningful to you. And giving people those options, you know, I feel like that, you know, I think sometimes people are angry at me because it's like, who's speaking up for, you know, your average funeral home? It's like, well, no, you're the power here. Like, we're this new much smaller option that really has to fight to get our message out and to educate people. And so that's why we're doing that. But yeah, I think that there is a real shift that COVID caused. I think that COVID, more than anything, it made people realize how important being there for the funeral is. I don't know if you saw this, but especially at my funeral home, right after, or when we finally started to have people back in, when we were allowed to do that, it seemed like everybody wanted to do that. It seemed like everybody wanted to come witness the cremation, or at least have a viewing. And I really do think that being apart from people so violently, you know, being so kept apart, really made people reevaluate how important it is to be together and those kind of community gatherings. And so I do think that will sort of help this different type of funeral gathering at least gain some more acceptance or interest.
Definitely. I definitely saw that during COVID. And I always think back to a service where we were only allowed to have 10 people in the funeral home. And I mean, this family was huge. And everyone was calling and leaving messages and just wanting the family to know that they were showing their support. So what we ended up doing was just tying little handwritten notes to balloons and filling the chapel with these balloons. And when the family walked in and saw that, even though people weren't there physically, just knowing that that many people had called in and sent their condolences, it move them in a way that I had never seen before. And it made me wonder in that moment, what is the long-term effect of
the lack of this gathering at this time. I don't think we'll know for years to come, but I remember having that thought. But I want to pivot just a second and go back to something you said about not being a spokesperson for the funeral industry. And you mentioned that, you know, people have become angry with you because of you presenting alternatives. And I want to know, I've gotten a little taste from the industry itself this past year for speaking up and saying, hey, this isn't fair, you guys. And it kept me up a couple nights. And I want to know, how do you handle that?
Ooh, well, that's a great question. Well, part of it is that I have been doing this work publicly with basically the same message. You know, I've been able to expand in the sense that, like, we have composting now, we have alkaline hydrolysis, we have exciting new things, but with essentially the same message publicly since 2011. Mm-hmm. And that's when we launched the Order of the Good Death, which is the nonprofit, and the videos that I do. And the very first video that I did, excuse me, as I told you, I'm recovering from a cold. So the hacking's actually been pretty down. In 2011, my very first video that I did, which I had absolutely the best intentions for, and I was just like, hi, I'm a young, you know, funeral director. Here's some thoughts and questions. One of the first comments I got was someone saying, I've been in this business for 15 years. I'm a funeral director in Balmer. You don't know what you're talking about. You young people make me sick. And I was just so horrified because I had never experienced, and this is, let's take you back to a time, 2011 was a much simpler place on the internet.
Oh God.
It was such a simple, beautiful little place. Like, I think the sort of the intensity of anger that can happen on the internet, we just had no idea yet. We were just babes in the woods, you know, piglets in the field, like just, you know, tromping through the violets, like no idea of what was to come. But that sort of intensity of someone just hating me from the funeral industry directed at me was so horrifying to me. And I could not imagine it. What would inspire this person to say that instead of having a conversation or some sort of dialogue? And, you know, through the years, that has ebbed and flowed and spiked. But I have had to get much, much better at it. Because obviously I would prefer people to just like me, not adore me or revere me, but just be like, she seems nice. You know, she's got good intentions, even if I don't agree with her. I like her. But that is not always possible on the internet. And I have to understand, and I've had to come to the sense of, listen, it's tough when you really love the American funeral industry as it is right mm-hmm. now, and you really love embalming, and you really think it's the past and the future of death, and that everything you do is right on and the best thing for the family. It's tough when you have someone like me who claims to be in the funeral industry, but actually seems much more like a consumer advocate in disguise, you know, who's barreling in and talking about dismantling all these things in the funeral industry and all these other things that families should be aware of, and how funerals should be less expensive, and how these, you know, and having all of these thoughts. I could see why you wouldn't like that. And I could see why it would feel like an attack on you. And that's why I say I don't work for the funeral industry. I work for families and I work for consumers. And, you know, I also think that it's probably very frustrating for them that my brand originally in 2011 started out as Ask a Mortician. Mm-hmm. And the fact that seems to some people like I'm just a normal mortician, you know, and that it's actually a bait and switch. And I'm like, actually, I'm trying to teach you about these totally different options and totally different ways to die. You know, I imagine that's frustrating too. So I get where all of their frustrations come from. But at the end of the day, I've just learned to always stay in my ethics and always know what I stand for and what I'm talking about and who I'm speaking up for, and the future of death that I'm speaking up for. And it doesn't bother me as much anymore. I can honestly say that it doesn't bother me that much anymore. Obviously, if it was someone who was a good colleague or someone who I was very connected with came to me and was like, I found this odious what you did, that would be terrible. But if it's someone that I don't know and someone who doesn't know me and doesn't agree with me for obvious reasons, it doesn't bother me as much anymore. But I do feel so awful for people like you, or people who, you know, are just starting to, I mean, you've been doing this for a while, but really attracting a different kind of audience and a larger audience, or some of the new people who are entering the space as advocates, it can be absolutely jarring. And I feel in some ways like I've sort of been a lobster in a pot, because again, I've been doing this since, for, you know, how many years, 12 years publicly, you know, in the funeral industry for longer. And I've just kind of gotten to grow up with it almost. It's always been a part of it. But for new people who step into the space with good intentions and just wanting to educate or share information, and then just getting blasted or being attacked, it can, we're just not meant to experience that as humans, that kind of just attack.
Yeah.
It's not, I mean, how have you found that you've been able to, because you're a much better example than maybe me, who's like this old hag that's been doing it for so long.
I think going into it, understanding that I'm having some very, I'm talking about things that are going to get some very intense reactions. Like, I'm walking on dynamite. I'm talking about race and inequality and cultural competency and appropriation. And those are hot button topics. But I think the thing that helps me is that I draw so much on the strength of my ancestors and what I believe to be my purpose. And unlike you, the majority of the comments that I get on YouTube are positive and encouraging. Oh,
to be clear, like 99.9% of my comments are positive. Yeah, this is just, and honestly, like at this point, most funeral directors or even people who are negative aren't really like lurking around.
Right.
So I didn't mean to imply that I'm like this, you know, hated put upon figure, because that's definitely not the case.
Right. And I think for me, I hate to say this, but it's the truth. When you live your life in my situation in a Black body as a woman, as a plus size woman, it's we're taught from a young age, you have to be 3 times smarter, 3 times more on top of your game, 3 times more prepared to go into situations. And just to give a perfect example, I attended NFDA in October of last year, which was an amazing experience. But after speaking up, I could literally feel the temperature in the room change from, okay, you're here, to what the hell are you doing? You know? And that felt intrusive to me, because I know I was speaking truth, not just my truth, but truth for so many people. And like I said, it kept me up for a while, a couple nights. I cried about it when I got back, and I heard the things that were being said about me, which were so false. They weren't true. But like you, I just had to say, you know what? I don't know these people, and these people don't know me. But what I do know is that the conversation that I'm having and the remarks that I'm making and the things that I'm exposing are going to make things better for the next Black person that goes into a situation, or the next person of color that doesn't feel like they can speak up and express their voice. So I think I lean a lot on that.
Oh, absolutely. I absolutely love and respect everything you just said there. And, you know, I want to also tell you that that's very brave. And I know that, actually, I don't know that people tell you that very often, because that's a thing that I think sometimes people miss, how much bravery that takes, and how much we know, especially in the context of you being a Black woman, I think, the way that you are taking the slings and arrows of these feelings, and the way that you are sort of, this maybe sounds a little woo-woo, but kind of cosmically absorbing that hatred and discomfort, especially in a room like NFDA. And to have to take that in, whether it's coming from online or live in a room full of men in various different kinds of gray suits who are not happy that you are there to say some difficult things about how we treat Black bodies or Black mortuary students in that space, that affects you in a way that it's hard to quantify.
Very
absorbing
I really appreciate that, Caitlin. And again, like you said, I don't want to make it seem like it was all negative, because after that difficult conversation and mustering up the courage to speak truth to power, I had people come up to me and say things like, I feel this way. I'm on this board. I'm on this review committee. And I just can't speak up because I'm afraid I'm going to lose my job. That to me is more hurtful than anything anybody could say to me.
Because, of course, yeah.
Yeah.
And that is more hurtful. I think that people who are interested in doing this kind of work, whether it's within the funeral industry or anywhere where you know that you're going to take a lot of heat for what you say. I mean, the first thing to do is to absolutely be sure that you believe to your core in what you're saying. Because if you're just throwing out things to be incendiary, we know what that looks like.
Right.
And that'll come back and bite you in the butt or hurt you. But if you really are centered in your truth and then you go up and do it, it can feel so outsized, the little bits of hate or anger. But when you actually break it down, like we've been saying, what keeps you going is that 99%+ are people who are really happy you're doing what you're doing and getting a lot out of what you're doing and appreciate what you're doing. And that's who you're doing it for. You're not trying to change yourself or change your truth for this very small percent of people who are actively, you know, would be absolutely beautiful and lovely to have a wonderful, open-hearted conversation and change their minds. And maybe that will happen. And I'm always open to that. But you have to speak up for the 99.9% of the rest of the people who are so appreciative or unable to say those things because of the position they're in.
Yeah. So we'll pivot again. With that, in taking that into consideration, how does Caitlin Doty take care of herself? Like, we talked a lot about the outside voices. What is your inside voice? Like, how do you keep that balanced and positive and keep yourself empowered enough to continue going?
That's a great question. I don't know that people don't usually ask me that. Maybe I don't seem like a balanced person. So they're like, what advice would she have? I, as much as I have to do a lot of my advocacy online, other than like watching YouTube videos and stuff, I am not an extremely online person. Okay. Because being extremely online can absolutely rot your brain, especially if you're trying to be some sort of advocate. Because I'm not deep in my comments. I'm not deep in my Twitter. I'm not looking for like message boards reactions to me. Like, I'm just nowhere around any of that. Like, if you're looking for me in those places, it's tumbleweeds, because I am living in my own world with my nice friends who have no connection to this at all. And we have I have a very safe, friendly, positive life outside of my advocacy. And that's incredibly, incredibly helpful for me. Doing a lot of traveling, having the support of a lot of people, really enjoying my coworkers, you know, all those things really help keep me going. And also, I think, again, it's having just done this for a really long time. And we talk about this a lot at my nonprofit, especially when there are people who are doing advocacy that we really enjoy or that we want to feature or that we really admire. We always think about the people who are doing advocacy for just really like heart-centered, deep, doing the work reasons versus people who are like, I have a TikTok. And that's not to say I'm not on TikTok, but I know there are plenty of people who are doing very real advocacy on TikTok. But there are these levels of like how like core is your advocacy? How much a part of you is your advocacy? Because if it really, really is, you can someday be an old hagvocate like me, who has just been doing it forever, because you always have that well of strength and ideas and values to go back to draw on. But if you're doing it for other reasons, or that well dries up, you got to go find it and nourish it and get yourself back to the point that you can do it again, or leave, you know, because nobody, you know, we don't need more content. We don't need more fluff. We don't need more, you know, which Ariel or which Little Mermaid character is you, are you, you know, real or whatever. We don't need more of that. We need more people who either are genuinely entertaining or genuinely advocacy focused. Maybe a little both. So I've gone on a rant now. I think because nobody asks me that question, I'm like, I don't know, all this stuff, word vomit. But yeah, that's a sort of general thing, is always having this real core of advocacy that I really do. Like, I'm a true believer. Everything that I say, I really, really believe in, and try and live my advocacy around. And then also, the biggest advice, do not be extremely online. Do not be deep in your comments. Do not take, you know, do not be checking all your DMs all the time. Do not be checking message boards. Just don't. Nope. None of that. As far as I'm concerned, no one tries to contact me ever.
I love that. So I want to go back to little Caitlin standing in the mall, looking at that girl, unfortunately falling to her death, and that fear that you felt when you witnessed this. How has your work soothed or fueled that fear?
Ooh, what a good question. What a good interviewer you are. You're really bringing it home. We're landing here. I mean, I often say that absolutely, you know, who amongst us does not have adult work around our childhood and things that really hurt us as children? And in a lot of ways, the fact that I have been able to spend so much of my life examining death, specifically death in culture and death in American culture, and how we've built up these fears and built up these barriers between us and our mortality and distanced ourselves from death. And being able to do that work and share that work with other people, I don't know that I feel like the luckiest person in the world, genuinely, that I've been able to do that. And I think, you know, being able to, I don't know if this is me in the situation where I'm like telling my younger self that this is gonna, I'm gonna do this, but being able to do the work connected with that and connected with that trauma, and hopefully give other people who had difficult experiences like that the context of, hey, you're not alone. It's weird that you could have had a tragedy in your childhood that nobody talked about, or that got totally buried, or that there was no funeral, or that there was no connection to death other than this absolute terror. And that's actually not normal, given how Americans 150 years ago, or, you know, people in most other places in the world now would handle that. That distance is not normal, and you kind of don't have to stand for it. You can have a different relationship with death. And it's not easy because the system isn't really set up to support that. But the more that we talk about it, and the more that we state plainly that we miss that and we want it back, the better chance that we have.
Definitely. So, second to last question, and a statement based on what you just said, you hit the nail on the head about the fact that we don't necessarily always have a connection to the death. And that makes me think about what you said about the way that we do death in this country, just being totally out of alignment and screwed up in so many ways. I go back to the shooting that happened in Texas last year, and we saw those horrific images online. We saw those videos of parents crying and screaming. And it's like the world just keeps going time after time after time after time. We just keep going. And to me, that is, it's disgusting. That keeps me up at night sometimes, just thinking about that. How do we just keep going without absorbing, or not even absorbing it, because we absorb it whether we know it or not, but pausing for that, in honor of that, in remembrance of that, in recognition of that trauma? What are your thoughts?
Well, I think that's the key. What you said is that you can ignore tragedy all day long. That doesn't mean it's not, you know, the same thing that's happening when you're standing up for yourself and your advocacy in a room full of funeral directors at the NFDA, whatever thing is coming into you there is coming into people when they see tragedy day after day. It's subconscious, but it is there. and it is being absorbed into your framework as a person living in the world. It's playing into your death fears. It's playing into the way that you handle conflict, or the way that you handle how you see other people and your hatreds and your bigotry. It all comes together and plays into the kind of people that we are. And so ignoring it just doesn't work. Like if I thought that ignoring death and the hard parts of death was an option, heck, maybe I'd do that too. But it's not. You know, they say, they always say grief waits. Grief waits.
Yeah.
And the only way out is through. Those are platitudes, but they're platitudes for a reason, because they're extremely true that if you don't have some way to work through that death, if you don't have some sort of ritual, which I define as is a combination of something that you mentally believe in and also maybe a physical activity mm-hmm. that you're doing, when you can do those things together, when you can have a funeral that has those elements, that's really participatory and celebratory and filled with grief and filled with despair and all of these things together, then you stand a chance to start to move forward. But just taking in all this grief and death and being like, it's okay, it's not gonna affect me. Yes, it is. It's gonna make you slowly over time into a completely different person. And so ignoring death and ignoring grief the way that we often do is not really an option.
Mm. Wow. And so on the other side of that, we are both in positions where we get paid for our knowledge about death care and to an extent grief. I am of the belief that a career in this industry and doing this work, even on an advocacy level, is not a vow of poverty. Have you experienced any struggle internally or criticism for the fact that you, I imagine, are paid to do what you do?
No, actually, an interesting one was when I started my first funeral home in Los Angeles, mm-hmm. and we were in a major paper, and because we were talking about home funerals and facilitating those as well, there was a comment that was like, in my small town, we just do this for free. You know, the older women come together and we file the death certificate and we help the family. And this is just community work. And my thought at the time is like, that's so beautiful and meaningful. This is Los Angeles,
right?
Like you, and I think about this all the time with when I hear about magical small towns where people, you know, go file the death certificate by hand and the clerk goes like, here you are, Miss Smith. Here's the signed death certificate. You know, go have your burial on your horse-drawn carriage. I'm so jealous. I am so, so jealous of having, especially when I've lived mostly in like big bureaucratic cities mm-hmm. where none of that is happening at all. And you have to have these kind of middlemen who do these things for you. It's just not an option to completely bypass that. So that's something that I've sort of dealt with. But as far as, you know, we haven't really gotten criticism for the nonprofit, because I think the work that we do, whether it's legalizing, working to legalize aquamation or human composting, or all of the resources that we have, or the grants that we give to people who are also doing this work, we haven't received criticism for that, because I think that people understand that. And then I think, you know, for the work I do, especially the advocacy through the videos and stuff, people understand kind of how people make money on YouTube.
Right.
You know, so that's not really like a question either. Although I very briefly did some ads and then got off that train right away. Cause even though they weren't like terribly they weren't scammy companies or anything, that just didn't feel right to me. But at the same time, if someone was younger and really trying to do this advocacy and that was their only option, because maybe people didn't know them as much or didn't want to donate, you know, I'd probably rather have the advocacy, even if there was like a brief Casper mattress ad in there, I guess, you know, right. rather than them not being able to do it or not being able to make it a priority. So that's actually, it's a very complicated conversation. But fortunately, very, very fortunately, and I realize that I'm in a very privileged position, I've kind of been like the Bernie Sanders of this, and like to be like, if you just donate 14 cents, you know, and having lots of really, really small donations that add up to a living wage for me, which is extremely awesome. And I understand very lucky for me, but it feels to me like a more ethical way to do it.
Right. And not only that, I mean, you have a whole team to support. It's not just the money's going to Caitlin. It's editors and publicists.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So many people, moving parts. So last,
I wish it all went to me.
You and me both.
And me and my yacht. Me and my death yacht.
Yes. Last question. What do you want your legacy to be, Caitlin?
I think a lot of the concepts that we've talked about in this conversation, which has been wonderful, by the way, thank you so much for having me. I think a lot of those things. I think a more open relationship with death, a funeral industry that is, I'd like to think that people would say that I pushed and drug the funeral industry more in a direction of a return to family involvement and connection with the cycle of life, connection with the fact that, you know, we are going to decay, we are going to die, and that body is going to decay, and that could go straight into the earth, and that could grow a tree, and that would make us part of the cycle, and that we're not more important than other animals and more important than other people, that we're all just this organic material and part of the cycle of life. And I would like people to say that I stood for that, and that my advocacy was always centered in those things. And that I hopefully, and you know, some of this is hard to tell in the long term, but I hope that I will be able to have that kind of effect long term. And I'm still enjoying doing it. Lo, these many years into it.
Well, thank you for continuing to do the work. If you wouldn't mind letting everyone know where they can find out about your books, your videos, and everything else that you have going on.
Sure. I think if you're interested in the advocacy specifically, Order of the Good Death, that's the nonprofit, that'd be a good place to start. If you're interested in me specifically, Ask a Mortician on YouTube will kind of see, let you see what I do. And then you can go to my website and buy books, or, you know, there's certainly, I've certainly churned out things for, if you're interested in the funeral industry and the history of the funeral industry and the reform of the funeral industry, you will fall down a deep rabbit hole with me. I will provide you a rabbit hole of content to fall into.
Definitely. And thank you again for just spending this with me. I was not expecting this conversation to be an hour long, but I'm glad it was.
Yeah, I'm glad too. Thank you so much again for the work that you're doing, and for being brave, and for all of the people that you really speak for.
I appreciate that, Caitlin. Thank you. And thank you to each and every one of you for listening. Live life, love hard. Talk to you next time.
Thank you for listening to the Death and Grief Talk podcast. If you'd like to learn more about The Grave Woman, visit www.thegravewoman.com.